This is Democracy Now!
Russia attacked Ukraine, and Russia is the country which must take a step now and do something so that peace becomes possible. What's necessary is the withdrawal of troops.
As Russian and Ukrainian forces battle for control of the eastern city of Bakhmut, calls are growing for the war to end. But deep divisions remain on how this could happen. A critical meeting of the G20 has ended without consensus on the Ukraine war. We'll get the latest. Then we go to Huwara in the occupied West Bank. On Sunday, hundreds of Israeli settlers attacked the village, setting homes and cars on fire, carrying out what's been described as a pogrom, all while the Israeli army looked on.
What we've seen here in this house is evidence of how big the crime carried out by the settlers, covered and protected by the army, is. It is clear that this move is supported by a political decision from the Israeli government.
Israel's new finance minister has called for Huwara to be wiped out or erased. We'll go to Huwara and Tel Aviv. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A critical meeting of foreign ministers from the G20 has ended in New Delhi, India, without any agreement on the Ukraine war. The meeting wrapped up after U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Russian Foreign Minister Sergey Lavrov spoke briefly in the first reported high-level meeting between U.S. and Russian officials in months. Their 10-minute conversation came after a Russian missile slammed into a high-rise apartment building in the Ukrainian city of Zaporizhia, killing at least 4 people. Meanwhile, Ukrainian officials said for the first time they're contemplating a tactical withdrawal from the eastern city of Bakhmut, where Russian forces have mostly cut off remaining civilians from humanitarian aid. This is Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky speaking earlier this week.
The hardest thing is still Bakhmut and the battles that are essential for the city's defense. I'll give you just one example. We are holding the staff meeting quite often now, at least twice a week. The last meeting was on Thursday, and today General Sursky reported that since this last meeting, about 800 enemies have been killed in his direction alone. Russia does not count people at all, sending them to constant assaults on our positions. The intensity of the fighting is only increasing.
Finland's parliament has voted overwhelmingly to join NATO, setting the country up to become the military alliance's 31st member. Wednesday's vote came just days after Finland began constructing a 120-mile wall topped with razor wire along its 800-mile border with Russia. In Hungary, the party of far-right Prime Minister Viktor Orbán said Wednesday it'll endorse the expansion of NATO to include Finland and Sweden. That leaves Turkey as the only NATO holdout. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has rejected Sweden's accession to NATO after accusing it of harboring dissidents he considers terrorists. Sweden and Finland had hoped to join NATO simultaneously. At least that's what the United States government wanted. The Biden administration has announced $619 million in high-tech arms sales to Taiwan, including new missiles for its F-16 fighter jets. The deal will primarily benefit weapons makers Raytheon and Lockheed Martin. After the sale was announced, Taiwan reported China's Air Force flew warplanes into airspace Taiwan considers part of its air defense identification zone for the second consecutive day. The U.S. Air Force says it's relieved 6 officers at a North Dakota nuclear missile base after their units failed a nuclear safety inspection. It's not clear exactly what lapses prompted the firings. The Minot Air Force Base is home to more than 24 B-52 nuclear-capable bombers, as well as 165 Minuteman III nuclear-tipped intercontinental ballistic missiles. This follows a previous safety lapse at the base in 2007, when a B-52 bomber flew to Louisiana carrying 6 nuclear-armed cruise missiles without the knowledge of the flight's crew. In Israel, police fired tear gas and stun grenades Wednesday at thousands of people who'd blocked a highway in Tel Aviv to protest plans by the far-right government of Benjamin Netanyahu to gut Israel's judiciary. 11 Israelis were hospitalized with injuries. It was the first time during weeks of mass protests that police used large-scale violence against Israeli citizens. Meanwhile, in Jerusalem, dozens of protesters dressed as handmaids from Margaret Atwood's dystopian novel, The Handmaid's Tale, rallied outside Israel's Supreme Court Wednesday.
Basically, it feels like we can say goodbye to democracy, because on one hand, the Knesset will have the ability to pass any law they want. On the other hand, the court will not have the ability to stop anything like that. Any court that would hit, that would hurt, whether women or LGBTs or any other minority, is going to pass with no one to stop it.
The protests came as the U.S. State Department condemned the comments of Israel's finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, who on Wednesday called on Israel to erase the Palestinian town of Hawara. His comments came after Jewish settlers attacked the town Sunday, burning cars and homes and killing a Palestinian man. This is State Department spokesperson Ned Price.
They were irresponsible. They were repugnant. They were disgusting. And just as we condemn Palestinian incitement to violence, we condemn these provocative remarks that also amount to incitement to violence. We call on Prime Minister Netanyahu and other senior Israeli officials to publicly and clearly reject and disavow these comments.
Later in the broadcast, we'll go to Hawara on the occupied West Bank, as well as Tel Aviv. The U.S. intelligence community has rejected claims that a foreign power was responsible for a series of unexplained injuries and illnesses suffered by U.S. officials working overseas. The episodes were dubbed Havana Syndrome after diplomats at the U.S. and Canadian embassies in Cuba reported dizziness, headaches and other symptoms in 2016. Since then, about 1,500 U.S. officials have reported ailments in 90 countries. After a two-year investigation and assessment by seven U.S. intelligence agencies found no credible evidence that any U.S. adversary possessed a weapon that could explain the ailments, which the report said were likely due to pre-existing conditions, conventional illnesses, and environmental factors. At the White House, Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre said the report's findings did not mean the U.S. would end medical support for those suffering.
This doesn't change the commitment that the president has in making sure that, you know, these families, our colleagues in the workforce, get the help and assistance that they need. And they're going to continue to work through that.
In Greece, at least 46 people were killed and dozens more hospitalized after a passenger train collided with a freight train late Tuesday in the central city of Larissa. It was the worst rail disaster in Greek history. On Wednesday, the Prime Minister, Kyriakos Mitsotakis, accepted the resignation of top transportation officials and said the crash was primarily due to, quote, tragic human error. Greece has declared 3 days of national mourning. Meanwhile, in Athens, police in riot gear fired tear gas at protesters who gathered outside the offices of the private company responsible for maintaining Greece's railways. Greece privatized its rail system and other public infrastructure in 2017 as part of an IMF bailout amidst the debt crisis. New York City has agreed to pay a multi-million-dollar settlement to protesters who were aggressively boxed in or kettled by New York police during the Black Lives Matter demonstrations that swept the country following the police murder of George Floyd in 2020. Over 300 people who were kettled, then beaten, detained or arrested by New York police at the June 4, 2020 Bronx protest will each receive $21,500. It's believed to be the largest class action settlement in a case of mass arrest. About a third of the demonstrators also previously settled with the city in separate claims. A Human Rights Watch investigation said the NYPD's conduct that day amounted to, quote, serious violations of international human rights law. In California, around 80 prisoners at two Immigration and Customs Enforcement facilities have gone on hunger strike for nearly 2 weeks. They say they are willing to risk their lives to fight against the inhumane conditions they're facing. A group of the hunger strikers from the Mesa Verde and Golden State Annex jails sued ICE and the private prison corporation GEO last week for retaliating against them by cutting off their heat, denying family visits and recreational time, and threatening solitary confinement. This is a striker speaking anonymously over the phone from the Golden State Annex. Listen closely.
I don't see it as a containment facility. It's a prison. It's four walls. People packed in here in sardines. So they could call it in other words for this place. It's a prison for me.
The hunger strike follows a labor strike protesting prisoners' $1 per day wage for 8-hour shifts. Earlier this week, local activists held a solitary protest at the Oakland State Building. Also this week, demonstrations took place across the United States, marking 20 years of harm by ICE, the Department of Homeland Security and Customs and Border Protection. Organizers are calling for an end to government funding of the agencies, which over the past 20 years have systematically targeted immigrants, Muslims, and communities of color using surveillance, detention, torture, military occupation, and inhumane immigration policies, they say. This is Dr. Mahalal from the Muslim Counterpublics Lab, speaking at Wednesday's protest in D.C.
The DHS has surveilled, detained, tortured, and punished communities with draconian immigration laws. DHS has also targeted Black Lives Matter activists, created and spearheaded a countering violent extremism program to target Muslim communities, tearing families apart, putting people in cages, and executing foreign nationals across the border.
A judge has ordered Starbucks to reinstate illegally fired employees, reopen closed stores, halt union-busting tactics, and take other reparative measures after ruling Starbucks engaged in egregious and widespread misconduct following the establishment of the chain's first unionized store in Buffalo, New York. Meanwhile, dozens of white-collar Starbucks workers have signed an open letter condemning Starbucks union busting and protesting the company's return-to-office mandate. The workers say, quote, morale is at an all-time low, and warn, quote, these actions are fracturing trust in Starbucks leadership. In Illinois, residents and activists from Chicago's South Side successfully passed two measures in this week's city election, calling for housing protections related to the construction of the new Obama Presidential Center. The 19-acre center will house a public library, playground, community centers, and a museum. But community members in the majority Black South Shore say the project has already led to gentrification and displacement. The measure passed Tuesday calls for eviction protections and rental assistance, city funding for home repairs and more mortgage assistance, development of affordable housing on city-owned lots, and 75% affordable housing on a vacant city-owned lot in nearby Woodlawn. Groups organizing with the Obama Community Benefits Agreement Coalition celebrated the overwhelming approval of the non-binding referenda and say they'll continue fighting to make sure Chicago follows through on their demands. And Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg has announced he's been diagnosed with inoperable pancreatic cancer, giving him an estimated 3 to 6 months to live. It was 51 years ago that the New York Times began publishing excerpts of the Pentagon Papers leaked by Dan Ellsberg, 7,000 pages of top-secret documents outlining the Pentagon's secret history of U.S. involvement in Vietnam since the 1940s. The leak exposed years of government lies and would end up helping to end the war in Vietnam and lead to a major victory for press freedom. Dan Ellsberg reports that since his cancer diagnosis, he's done several interviews and webinars on topics including Ukraine, nuclear weapons, and First Amendment issues. Ellsberg wrote, quote, I work better under a deadline. It turns out I live better under a deadline. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, calls are growing for the war in Ukraine to end, but deep divisions remain on how this could happen. More in a minute. Kate Fagan here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Nermeen Sheikh. Hi, Nermeen.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
A critical meeting of foreign ministers from the G20 has just ended in New Delhi, India, without any agreement on the war in Ukraine. India's foreign minister said, quote, "We could not reconcile as various parties held differing views." Earlier today, U.S. Secretary of State Tony Blinken spoke briefly with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov in their first meeting since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. The G20 meeting comes a week after China released a 12-point peace plan to end the war. On Wednesday, Chinese President Xi Jinping joined with the Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko, calling for a ceasefire and negotiations. The United States has dismissed China's proposal. On Wednesday, Blinken said he has seen, quote, zero evidence that Russian President Vladimir Putin's ready to engage in negotiations. Meanwhile, the Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni has urged the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi to play a central role in facilitating ceasefire negotiations. The G20 meeting comes as intense fighting continues in eastern Ukraine, where Russian forces have almost fully surrounded the city of Bakhmut, where thousands of Ukrainian civilians have been cut off from humanitarian aid. Ukrainian officials say they're now contemplating a tactical withdrawal from the city. To talk more about the possibility of negotiations to end the fighting, we're joined by two guests. From Berlin, we're joined by Wolfgang Sporer, a conflict manager, adjunct professor at the Hertie School in Berlin. From 2014 to 2020, he was the head of human rights for the special monitoring mission in Kyiv of OSCE, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. And in London, we're joined by Vladislav Zubak, professor of international history at the London School of Economics. His December article for Foreign Affairs is headlined, "No one would win a long war in Ukraine. The West must avoid the mistakes of World War I." He's the author of Collapse, The Fall of the Soviet Union. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's begin with Professor Vladislav Zubak. Let's take the title of your piece. As you talk about, no one would win a long war in Ukraine, and you put negotiations in context going back to World War I. Can you lay out your argument and what you think needs to be done?
Ola, thank you. Good to be on your show. I would call it untimely thoughts, because the moment my article was published, President Zelensky of Ukraine declared in the U.S. Congress his desire for a complete victory. So I should say in advance that my proposal was not to impose any negotiations in any way, because it's manifestly unfeasible. I'm very skeptical, even more today than back in December, that any sides are ready for negotiations. My idea was to map out how would it look after Russia has to accept its defeat, and how to make it a more palatable a solution for some parts of the Russian elites that want to switch from this attitude of aggression and imperialism to a different, more pragmatic approach to the West. So I went through several obvious aspects of possible maps. First of all, continue to help Ukraine, of course, to achieve military gains, but also indicate on a political level to Russian elites and Russian populace that this war is unwinnable for them. And the longer the war continues, there will be a greater danger of another collapse, just as what happened to the Soviet Union 30 years ago. The second part of this map is to offer some possible carrots up to negotiations, up to trade-offs, to return Russia after it accepts its defeat and withdraws its forces from Ukraine into the international economic, financial, and political space. In political sense, I wrote that we need to offer the return of legitimacy to certain individuals and certain groups of Russian elites as a trade-off for them accepting a defeat. In economic field, there should be some talk about the conditions for removing sanctions, because we know from the Cold War that, and actually from the history of World War One, after Germany accepted an armistice, it was still subject to very humiliating and painful blockade by the Allies. So what there should be some discussion, what will Russians gain economically if they accept status quo ante and agree to talk with Ukraine on the damage control? And financially, there's an issue, of course, of frozen assets in compensation to Ukraine. All we hear from some supporters of Ukraine and Ukrainians themselves is about sticks and punishment. We don't hear anything about carrots, which is understandable. We are in the midst of brutal war when Russians committed so many atrocities. But without certain carrots, at least addressed for the post-war period, we risk repeating the dangerous path after World War One.
Professor Zubok, that foreign affairs piece, I mean, speaking of, you just mentioned that the war may be unwinnable for Russia, but you begin the foreign affairs piece by citing comments by General Mark Milley, the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He said that the probability of a complete Ukrainian military victory was not high. Nevertheless, he said President Biden wanted Ukraine to decide whether to negotiate with Russia. Let's go to his comments. He made these comments in November.
The military task of militarily kicking the Russians physically out of Ukraine is a very difficult task. And it's not going to happen the next couple of weeks unless the Russian army completely collapses, which is unlikely. So in terms of probability, the probability of a Ukrainian military victory, defined as kicking the Russians out of all of Ukraine, to include what they define or what they claim is Crimea, to the probability of that happening anytime soon is not high. The Russian military is really hurting bad. So you want to negotiate at a time when you're at your strength and your opponent is at weakness. And it's possible, maybe, that there'll be a political solution.
So, Professor Zubok, those were comments that General Mark Milley made in November. Your response to what he said, and especially this comment that he made about negotiating from a position of strength, how do you assess the situation now? And what prospects do you see for any talks between Ukraine and Russia?
Well, we have 3 months when neither side made any breakthrough after the spectacular liberation of parts of Ukrainian territory by the Ukrainian army. So more and more people, including Fareed Zakaria on CNN, begin to talk about a stalemate, which is what was the starting point of my piece in December. But I'm not a military expert, and war is a highly volatile thing. So I think Ukrainians disagree with Milley, and they're more confident than Milley in their own capacities to inflict humiliating military defeats and even forcing Russians out of Crimea. They have secret plan. They have various stratagems for that, which I'm not aware of. But we may have surprises. But what I want to stress, Milley is a good authority because he went through several wars where you achieve military goals, but you don't achieve political goals. The war in Iraq showed that. The war in Afghanistan showed that. So in a sense, to add to his argument about the military, definite military defeat, complete military defeat of Russia is unlikely, I would add a political factor. As long as Putin and his entourage continues to view this war as a war about heritage and a war of defeat or defeat of Ukraine or defeat of Russia, which equals in his mind to the demise of Russia. So until then, we have an intractable political dilemma. There is no political counterplay to this, no political alternative that the West offers to Putin. There were a few words by Biden recently. He said in Warsaw, this is not a war against Russian people and all that. But, you know, it needs to be more loud and more pronounced and more specific, I would say, so that parts of Russian elites and parts of populace would see, wait a minute, it's not about a dilemma whether we win or perish. It's a senseless war. And we better end it soon. So, you know, the West must come up with something more politically specific to address Russian perennial insecurity and Russian concerns, which is not easy. You know, the third part of my article is about selling peace. There's so many people who would accuse me of appeasing Putin, which was not my intention, who blamed me for offering a ramp off for Russia, which was not my intention. My intention was to avoid the aftermath of the war, which would be dangerous both for Russia with nuclear weapons in Russia and for its neighbors and for the architecture of European peace in general.
Wolfgang Spohrer, you were involved in the Minsk talks from the outset. Could you talk a little bit, give us some background of this war? You were involved, as I said, from 2014 with the Russian annexation of Crimea as a member of the OSCE's special monitoring mission.
Well, the talks that took place in Minsk were there to implement the so-called package of measures that was concluded in March of 2015. This, in essence, meant there were security provisions and there were political provisions. Political provisions were, in essence, about giving more rights to the people living beyond the so-called contact line, whereas the political provisions were about also transforming the state of Ukraine for making it into a more decentralized society, etc. The security provisions, however, were in essence about getting a ceasefire. And both parts of these provisions were never fulfilled, because the Russian Federation really never showed a big interest in fulfilling the security provisions of the Minsk agreements, and the Ukraine never really felt a big intention, in my opinion, to fulfill the political provisions of the Minsk agreements. However, I think it is a mistake to believe that these Minsk agreements, just because they did not lead to full implementation, were actually a complete failure, because they were not. And this is where we can learn potentially some things for the situation today. The Minsk agreements did not solve the Russian-Ukrainian conflict. They did not. But they did bring about certain humanitarian positive steps. They brought about temporary ceasefires. They brought about disengagement zones around the humanitarian facilities. They brought about the reconstruction of critical infrastructure. So they brought about humanitarian steps. They did a second thing, and this is they kept a minimum of trust between the sides, between the Russians and the Ukraine, between the Russian Federation and Ukraine, because they were simply meeting every every 2 weeks, and they had a real possibility to voice their concerns, to talk to each other officially, but also to talk to each other, you know, outside of the official settings, which is something that brings a minimum of trust. So, and therefore, my proposal was to somehow try to get to proper negotiations.